Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for being here. Sunday here on WPVC, Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Gotta love being here on Sundays. You get the best of WPVC, Homegrown, and the Wake-Up Call. And today, we're going to do our thing with the folks who know all about your grandparents, your parents, and the other elderly folks in your life. Doris Gelman from Gelman Law, good morning.
Good morning to you.
And Katie Caverly, Managing Director at I-Corps of Charlottesville.
That's right. Good morning.
I was looking around and wondering, I'm always searching for topics on what to do. My wife discovered this topic and pointed it out to me. Doris, I need to tell you more about that later. And I was saying, you know, everybody needs to know more about this because the United States, let's talk about this. What's the percentage of elderly in the U.S.? How does that work? At what age are you qualified as elderly, and what is the percentage?
Let me address that first, and then Katie might have a different answer. I think the most important thing to realize in my practice is that age is not a number. It's not about how old you are. It's about what your needs are, both in care and in terms of planning and those sorts of things. But from an official quote-unquote standpoint, the government, I believe, probably pegs the number at 65. And it's a convenient place to get statistics. For instance, recently there was a report from the Census Bureau, literally this week I read it, that said in the last 10 years, since 2010, the population of the United States over the age of 65 has grown by 30%. That's an enormous number.
By how much?
30% since 2010. That's people over 65 has grown by 30% since 2010.
You know, right now there are 10,000 people turning 65 every single day in the United States. It's a lot.
That is. Does it make a difference that, I mean, you see, I think back, I'm still under that number, although my hair argues, that I look back in my life, because I come from a large extended family and a long extended family. I mean, when I graduated high school, I still had three great-grandmothers alive. And when I look back at that, I had multiple 70-year-olds that were much more, and I'm going to use this word loosely, much less capable than my parents are now, who are in their 70s and go to work daily and go work out regularly and travel all the time. And so how things have changed in a generation, and how does that affect what the two of you do in the elderly care business?
Well, I'll start, but then I'm going to toss it to Katie because she has a pretty good kind of short answer to this. And she's looking at me like, what is she talking about? The answer to that is we live much longer than we used to in terms of our actual length of life. In a very short period in the last century and this century, that's changed dramatically. And part of it is technology. Part of it is medicine. And you touched on it in relating to how your parents are exercising more. They probably eat better than the generation before. You know, 30 years ago, people were eating stuff fried in lard every day. We don't do that anymore. So, you know, it's a dramatic change in how we care for people. And how we live our lives is making a big difference in how long we live.
Are you saying that collard greens weren't green enough?
Well, you have that wonderful slide that I've hijacked from you in presentations.
Yeah, you know, 100 years ago, the average lifespan was typically to about 47. We died at home, surrounded by family, and we typically died of an infectious disease, be it pneumonia or tuberculosis. And the death trajectory, as they call it, was really steep. In other words, you went along healthy, 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 caught this infectious disease, and then on average 7 to 11 days later, you died. Today is very, very different. The good news, as Doris pointed out, is we're living much longer. But that slope, that trajectory is flattened. So we're managing more chronic illnesses. We are interacting with the U.S. healthcare system a lot more. We have more inputs into our maladies. A lot of our maladies are sort of coordinated by specialists. So there is a lot more input into how we live from a physical standpoint. But certainly we are living longer, and you know, Doris and I always experience firsthand that how societies age, whether they tilt young or tilt older, has dramatic effect on culture and other avenues of society that are, I think, important to keep track of.
Again, we are talking about elderly law and care. Our guest today, Katie Caverly. She's the managing director of ICOR of Charlottesville. We also have Doris Gelman. She's here from Gelman Law that specializes in elderly law.
Yeah.
Katie, ICOR of Charlottesville, never heard of it before. I went searching for guests for this topic today, maybe because my extended family doesn't live in Charlottesville, so I don't have the need locally.
Yeah.
And I don't feel that I've reached the elderly issue yet, not by the numbers, nor by the needs. ICOR of Charlottesville, tell me more.
Yeah, we're a care management firm. Another way to think of it is private case management. So we're advocates. We have medical advocates on staff in the form of registered nurses who will attend doctor's appointments and perform a variety of screenings and assessments. Are you safe at home? They'll look at your medicines. A lot of times our nurses are recommending de-prescription programs under the belief that less is more as we age. We're also financial advocates. So we will stand in as an agent under a power of attorney. We work with the local court system. In the event of an incapacitated adult, we can stand in as their guardian or conservator. We're also a sort of a housing advocate. Where is this person best situated to achieve the best condition of existence? Is it home? Is it assisted living? The vast majority of our clients want to stay home. We try to help that come true. And then we also look out for psychosocial needs. Are they isolated? Are they depressed? Not a normal phase of aging. Depression is not. And so we're trying to look at the whole person. And the best analogy I often use is we're a little like a surrogate daughter. We tend to step in when there is no family or family lives remotely, or you've got that sandwich generation, right? An adult daughter, typically, that's got young children of her own as well as aging parents and just can't squeeze it all in. And sometimes we'll intervene, as Doris well knows, unfortunately, when an adult child is an inappropriate care provider and fiduciary for an elderly person. We will come in the aftermath of exploitation and neglect and abuse and some of those more unfortunate matters.
So who calls for I-Corps?
We have a couple of referral sources, one being estate attorneys quite a bit. So what will happen is an elderly person will realize, okay, it's time to pull together an estate plan, right? I need a will, I need an advanced medical directive, and I need a power of attorney. I've got to appoint an agent. I don't have anybody, right? Never married, no kids, or whatever that circumstance is. And so those estate attorneys will sometimes recognize that they come talk to I-Corps as a potential to fill that role. We'll also get the adult daughter who will call us. It's not uncommon. You know, the daughter was home for Easter and spent some time with mom before heading back to her home in North Carolina. And while home, realized that mom isn't doing too well. And so she'll start to poke around the internet and see what sources are here locally. So we get a lot of adult children. And then my favorite kind of client are the elderly themselves, right? The people who know they need a plan but don't have family to fill that role. And likewise, come across us and then come in and chat with us about what we can do. But those are predominantly the three biggest referral sources. Every now and then we'll get a call directly from Adult Protective Services or law enforcement when there's been, you know, bad deeds performed and now we've got an elderly person who needs some protection.
We also have Doris Gelman with us from Gelman Law. Doris, Gelman Law specializes in elderly law.
Yeah, I've got to be careful about the word specialize because the bar does not like us to use that term unless we have specific credentials, like the patent bar. You take an exam to be a patent attorney.
Okay.
There is no such elder law license. So I use the term focus. I focus my practice on elder law. So now I've complied with what the bar tells me I have to do. So let me explain what that means.
Okay.
You know, people come into contact with attorneys for any variety of reasons. Your kid gets a DUI and you need a criminal defense attorney to help get him out of jail, get him the least possible sentence, whatever the case may be. You have real estate you want to sell and you need a real estate attorney to help you do the closing.
Do they specialize in this?
Not necessarily.
Things?
Not necessarily. Many of them do. For example, I know there are many criminal defense attorneys in town that focus entirely on criminal defense. And there are real estate attorneys that do entirely that.
Specialize in them, though?
I never use that word because we're not allowed to.
Okay. So there's no test?
There is no test for any of those
either.
Things. We all take the same bar exam.
Okay.
Right? So the attorneys in Virginia, to practice before the courts in Virginia, you take a bar exam. It has wills, it has real estate, it has criminal, it has procedure, it has every subject you can think. I think there were 26 areas of law in Virginia that we were tested on to be licensed as an attorney. The day after the bar exam, you begin forgetting all those. And you start looking around for the one that you like.
Got it.
And at the time that happened for me in Virginia, I happened to be caring for my father, who was in a 3-year, what Katie referred to as that trajectory of dying. He was in a long three-year decline. And because I was able to be with him and be that adult daughter, caregiver, advocate, I was exposed to the need that adults, elderly people have to have someone that knows what they're doing, that understands the system. Now, my father was not an idiot. He was a very successful businessman, a very smart man, but he was a very sick man by that time. He did not have dementia. His mind was intact, but he was in pain. He was depressed. He was physically debilitated, and all of those things made it very difficult for him to take in a lot of technical medical jargon, understand what was going on, understand the consequences if he chose this care setting over that care setting, how was it going to be paid for, how were they going to make their resources last. and then how we were going to take care of my mother once he passed. How do we do all those things? So I saw up close and personally exactly what the need was. And it didn't occur to me until I was in it that this was a path for an attorney. And I began to search out who was doing this kind of work. And there were already quite a few that were doing that.
Was your dad open to the help?
Oddly enough, as like most adult children, my dad loved me and cared about me. But when he looked at me, he saw a 15-year-old. And that 15-year-old was rebellious and drank and carried on. And he was not about to trust me with a lot of things until he really didn't have any choice anymore. But he had named, for example, he had named my brother, who was living overseas at the time, as his power of attorney. So I was not in a position to be able to help with some of those things.
Why do you need to focus on elderly law? Don't many people have someone who's already their regular attorney?
Sure. And in many cases, that's enough. If all you need is a simple will, first of all, you can go down to Staples, down to the office supply store, and they have forms on the shelf that you can buy for, $29.99, make out the form, sign it, get it notarized. That is not what a lawyer does when they do an estate plan. And there are attorneys who do general practice, and they do all those things. They do real estate, they do criminal law, they do estate planning. But they don't know the full depth and breadth of a particular subject necessarily. And they may not be as current on the current regulations and law as they relate to a particular topic area. And then I'll give you an example of what that law is, because it's not just about wills. I write a lot of wills. But the other thing that I need to know is, well, what are the rules and regulations about Medicare? And what are the rules and regulations about Medicaid when it comes to paying for your care? What are the kinds of things that apply when someone is incapacitated? What does the law say about what happens to someone if they are not able to make decisions and are not taking good care of themselves? What happens next? And that's another whole area of the law. And not every lawyer knows that. The example I usually give, and we talked about this earlier, is that when you have a broken bone, you don't go to a dermatologist to get it set, right? Same thing. When your issues concern something to do with older people, you're probably not going to want to go to a criminal defense attorney.
Doris and I were talking last week. I came across a POA document where...
Power of attorney.
Yeah, sorry. Power of attorney, where the principal was asking whether or not I would serve as her agent. And the document was concerning on a number of levels. It didn't take effect immediately. Rather, it sprung into action upon certain conditions being met. And those conditions, as worded, struck me as a little mushy. Pulling from memory, I think it said something like, my agent may act when and if I am mentally incapacitated, physically disabled, and there was a third one. Think about that just from a practical point of view. First of all, I'm not sure why physical disability would necessarily be the spark by which an agent starts exercising control. And moreover, if I bring that document to a local bank, be it Wells Fargo, Bank of America, or UVA Credit Union, that financial institution is going to have a difficult time knowing when and how to honor my authorities. And so I can present that document that says, Mrs. Jane Smith has appointed me her agent, here's the document. But that financial institution is going to look at that and say, well, is Jane physically disabled? Is she mentally incapacitated? If she is, I will need a doctor's note to that effect. I mean, and that is why a good attorney who understands the ramifications of some of these documents that involve the seniors, why they're worth their weight in gold, because just a, you know, there is an art to I think, creating power of attorney documents. And again, if you haven't sort of lived through the repercussions of drawing up one poorly, you may miss some of those nuances.
Again, here we are talking about elderly law and care with our guest today, Katie Caverly. She's the managing director at ICOR of Charlottesville. You can find them at www.icorcharlottesville.com if you want to learn more. And Doris Gelman of Gelman Law. It's gelmanlaw.com. Let's take our first break. I want to come back. Let's talk about mental capacity. You mentioned that in the power of attorney. We'll be right back. All right, we're back again. Elderly law and care. Are we divided here, Doris? Are you doing the elderly law? And Katie, you're doing the elderly care. Is that, you know, not divided like on either side of our wall, but...
No.
There's a lot of overlap.
There is an awful lot of overlap in what Katie and I do, and we often work together, as I think we call each other our working wives. We travel very closely in this path of working with elderly people, and there are a lot of other people in the community that we also work with, and they know who they are. We'll encourage you to bring them on, financial people and lots of other people. What we do, though, tends to be a slightly different track. I was thinking this morning that there is I don't know how familiar you are with something called a Venn diagram. If you were to draw a Venn diagram,
those
Katie
are the circles
I,
that you draw.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
For
very,
those who don't know, you draw the circle here, circle in one corner, circle in another, and you see which ones overlap and
exactly,
where.
Which is impossible to do on radio, right? If we were on television, I would draw a Venn diagram that would show what Katie does and what I do, and I can tell you that they would overlap quite a lot. There would be a large area that overlaps, but the part of mine that's outside the overlapping area is having to do with the law, right? And understanding how the law is applied. They guide how I write these documents that we're talking about. They guide how I advocate for someone in court, which I can do and Katie cannot. Katie can serve at the court's appointment, but I may be the one that is either defending against that appointment or bringing the request to make an appointment called guardianship or conservatorship. So there's a technical difference in what we're licensed and able to do. Katie has different talents and experience that I do not. And so when I need that, I call on her and her staff of RNs and personal care assistants and what do you call Laura?
Personal needs coordinator.
Personal needs coordinator who organizes practical things for people, because I don't do that. I don't schedule caregivers. I don't shop for insurance. I don't do those things. Her people do.
I'm curious. So let's talk about the mental capacity. Katie, you touched on that.
Yeah.
I'm talking about power of attorney.
Okay.
So let's start there. When you draw up a power of attorney, it's often done so because of concern of the mental capacity.
It should be done long before there's a concern about mental capacity.
Anybody 18 and over, I just interrupted you. Anybody 18 and over should have a power of attorney document drawn up.
Yeah. So you're saying that... If I don't have one now, I should get one done.
Well, let me sort of expand on that a little bit. If God forbid, and I'm sorry, producer, I am going to knock on wood, you walk out of the studio and you're hit by a car and you're incapacitated, who's going to pay your bills for you? Who's going to make decisions for you? Who's going to do all those things for you? You don't have to be old for that to happen. If you have a brain injury, that can happen. You could simply be unconscious in the hospital, and that's going to happen. And somebody has to have the legal authority to make decisions and take actions on your behalf. You can't just do it. Somebody can't just start using your ATM card. You're married, right?
I am.
Right. And so you and your wife might have a joint checking account. So she could write checks on that account and do some things with your bank account. But let me give you an example where that falls apart. I had a guy that had a massive stroke and found himself over in one of the local nursing homes, completely out of it. I mean, he was alive, but he was incapacitated mentally and physically. And his wife was saddled with taking care of all the family's business now, and she had never done that. She didn't know how to pay the bills and all those things. She picked that up. She had a joint account. She was able to pay the light bill, the rent, and all those other things. But she realized that she was paying this big cable TV bill, which she wasn't using. He got the cable for sports. He watched a lot of sports. So she called up the cable company, who shall remain nameless. You got two choices.
Right? Yeah.
So called up the cable company and said, I would like to cancel our cable bill. And they said, okay, great, that's fine. Can I have your husband's power of attorney? Because the bill was only in his name. So she couldn't cancel the cable without having his legal authority to do so. Seems like a small thing, but there's a million and one of those things that come up.
If you think about some of the more well-known debates among family as to when and if to remove life support, and I'm thinking back on the Terry Schiavo case. I hope I'm saying her last name. Schiavo. I think Terry Schiavo was in her early 40s. You know, she wasn't a 70-year-old whose family was debating on whether or not to remove life support. She was younger than I am. So, again, anybody 18 and older needs a power of attorney document, the very, very least.
I read that, I think I got this from Doris's page, whether this was an article or a one of your other interviews, the difference between writing the check and balancing the checkbook.
That sounds like it might have come from Katie's, but I'll address it. It's possible that you have the physical ability to write a check and sign it. And it's possible that you have the physical ability, somebody else writes the check, and you sign it, right? Because the banks don't actually look at that information. They scan that, and as long as there's something in the security seal is on it. But when it comes to balancing a checkbook, you have to be able to take in that information, to understand that information, to manipulate that data, do the math, and make sure that it works out, right? That you have enough funds to write a check. The physical ability to write a check does not mean that you have the mental capacity, that you understand the consequences of writing that check.
So, Katie, sorry if I passed your ability to put that together and gave Doris credit, but for ICOR to be doing that work for you?
Yeah, so we would need the authority to do so. In other words, we can sit with a person, with our client, help them sort their mail, throw away the junk, determine if a bill is legitimate, and help them fill out the check. What's the date? They sign it. They're still acting under their own powers. For us to begin signing the check and interacting with and communicating with their financial institution, we'd need the legal authority to do so, right? That financial institution isn't going to recognize us without that power of attorney document stating explicitly that we have these powers. So the difficulty is, and Doris and I have seen it too many times, is that an individual doesn't complete a power of attorney, they advance in age, dementia sets in, and they lose capacity. At that point, it is too late to create and appoint a power of attorney. The very act of appointing an agent demands that you understand what it is you're doing and that you understand the consequences of doing so. So if you've already lost mental capacity, it is too late. And, you know, at I-Corps, we're always talking about, look, build a plan, because if you don't have a plan, then decisions start to be made for you by others. And those may not be people you would otherwise want to make decisions for you. Doris said, God forbid, Rick, you leave this studio, get hit by a car. Let's say you weren't married and you're laid up at UVA. You know, there's going to be an ethics committee at UVA that starts to make decisions for you about whether or not we remove Rick from life support. Because you haven't made those wishes clear.
If I make an announcement here on the studio and it's on the podcast, does that help?
Well, let me get a psychologist to make sure you're of sound mind before we do that. Which brings up an important part of this whole discussion about capacity is who makes that determination of whether someone has capacity or not. And it isn't the adult daughter, because that happens often that I get a phone call that says, and literally the language is like this, hi, I need to make an appointment to get a power of attorney over my mother. And my answer to that, if I don't hang up the phone right away, is, okay, have your mother call me, because mom has to be able to do that, not daughter. Daughter can't, I will not even allow her to be present while I'm having the conversation with mom. She needs to be able to make that decision to grant a power of attorney independently of any other influence. If someone comes to me and we're having that conversation, mom is sitting in my office and we're having the conversation, and I have any doubt as to whether she is able to make a power of attorney, does she have a little dementia? Is she repeating herself too often? Has she forgotten her daughter's name? All of those questions are going through my mind while I'm talking. And if I'm not 100% certain that she's, as we say, intact, cognitively intact, I'm going to send her to her doctor, and I'm going to want her doctor to confirm for me that she does indeed have the capacity to make a power of attorney.
I see a lot of people, both the principal who appoint an agent under their power of attorney as though it's an honorarium. I'll take the oldest child. Or conversely, I'll see siblings fight amongst themselves as to who gets to be mom's agent under a power of attorney.
That was my situation. We talked earlier about my brother being overseas and my dad having appointed him. He was the eldest son, so of course he was the power of attorney. Forget that he had a daughter who was an elder law attorney that lived 20 minutes away. Right? No angst towards my brother, but it just didn't make practical sense that was the person that you picked. It was an honor to name his eldest son.
Right.
The criteria is often misguided, right? Again, it's I'll take my oldest child. I always sort of feel like when I see siblings arguing amongst themselves as to who's going to be mom's POA, I immediately think something is terribly amiss, because nobody in their right mind wants to be an agent under a power of attorney. It's tremendous work. It's a nuisance. The financial institutions.
And the stress.
There's stress.
I mean, just the emotional stress, I would think.
Yeah, and it's a bear in many practical ways, gaining access to accounts. And again, you know, canceling a cable subscription can suddenly feel like moving a mountain. So nobody in their right mind wants or should want to be an agent under a power of attorney. And so when I see siblings arguing that point, I always think that there's probably an assets behind that.
There's that, or there's what I call the sandbox issues, where you have siblings who grew up in a household where there was a lot of vying for attention from mom and dad, and they have these unresolved issues that they've carried into adulthood. Yeah. Thinking mom loves me more if she names me the power of attorney rather than my little brother or my older sister. She bought popsicles for all of them one day and didn't buy me one. It's my turn to be the golden child. And that happens way more than I would like to say happens. It happens a lot.
Selecting your POA is a strategic decision. You ought to approach it as such. Whoever your agent is going to be not only has to be willing, but a suitable choice. Prudent, savvy, trustworthy.
Detail-oriented.
Have the time for this. So again, it's a real job. I always worry when people are sort of blasé about it. And the other thing that Doris and I will see sometimes is adult children will sometimes mistake that when they're the appointed agent, it's their power. It's not. It's the principal's power. What you've been asked to do, ethically, legally, is to act in their stead, to act as they would if they had the ability to do so. The power, I think you're the one that says this, the power is in the document. You suddenly, by being agent under a power of attorney, can't crack open mom's savings account and do with it what you will. You're not the power. The power are her wishes, and you're simply the embodiment of making sure those wishes get carried out.
The way I usually phrase it when I'm talking about this is if I could talk to Richmond, I would ask them to do this in the legislature, to change that term power of attorney to responsibility of attorney, yeah. Because that's what you've really accepted, and you do have to accept that responsibility. The legal term that's used is fiduciary. That's a dollar word that you could spin out to 25 cents and just say it's a responsibility. You have a elevated responsibility to that person you are serving, and you can be sued when you violate it. You can be sued for breach of fiduciary duty. So if mom has given you a power of attorney, she has consented for you to act as her agent. She has not consented for you to write checks to go buy a new car for yourself. That is not the power that you have. You have a responsibility to do things in her best interest, not your own.
Again, we are talking about elderly law and elderly care with Doris Gelman from Gelman Law, Katie Caverly from I-Corps of Charlottesville. Talking about mental capacity for a few more moments, that was interesting, troublesome to read and listen in preparation for today's show about how some family members discover the need for of mental capacity issues. There was one where a family member, I guess, went home, I'll say, for a holiday and discovered that their elderly father had many guns in the home that were loaded, but she had been letting her kids go to grandpa's house for a while. Would tell that story?
I probably did. It's actually someone I know who indeed works in elder care in one of the local nursing homes and knows all about elderly people, knows all about dementia and all these other things, but in her own family was not aware that her own father still had loaded guns, and she was taking her children, his grandchildren, to the house on a regular basis with no knowledge that those guns were in the house, or at least accessible to the children, which is very common in Virginia. I mean, a lot of Virginians have guns in the house. So I guess where that's important from the issue of capacity is, I think I kind of want to sort of discuss this a little bit. The question that always comes up for me is the capacity to do what? Do you have the capacity to drive? Do you have the capacity to own guns? Lots of different levels in there.
Yeah, and we'll talk about healthcare when we come back. We need to take our next break. Again, Doris Gelman and Katie Caverly as we talk about elderly law and care. Let's take our next break, and we'll be right back here on WPVC Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. And back in action with our guest today talking about elderly law care. I wanted to talk about health care and health care insurance. And Doris, you mentioned your need, especially early on when you guys started taking care of your father, mm-hmm. and discovering the need to know all the issues with Medicare, et cetera. But let's slide into this. The conversation was about the health care power of attorney. So let's start there. I didn't really think that there was a difference. Once you got a power of attorney, you got a power of attorney. You can sort of shrink it to do just one?
That's the attorney question, but there is power over your person, your body, your medical decision making, and then there is power over your estate, your stuff.
Your stuff, as I call it, your property, your money, your finances, your personal property. That when you're talking about what in the legal world we call it a general power of attorney or financial power of attorney or property power of attorney, talk to any attorney, you'll get a different name for it. On the other hand, you have something called a health care or medical power of attorney. In Virginia, those are actually two different sections of the Virginia Code that cover those. They can be the same person. You can name the same person to have both of those legal powers. But they are actually distinct, as Katie points out. A health care power of attorney is about the person, your body, your health. What nursing home, what hospital, what doctor, what medications, that's all done in a healthcare power of attorney. It is not effective until you are incapacitated, period. You make your own decisions until you are, quote unquote, deemed incapacitated. A general power of attorney can take effect immediately, and it only has to do with money, property, bank accounts, investments, your house, stuff.
Katie, do you see people who are residents, not residents, because you don't have people live at I-Corps. I-Corps goes to their homes.
Correct, yeah.
So are you
wherever their home is.
Or wherever their home is.
Yeah.
Do your clients have both medical and general?
They do.
Or just one?
Nope, they'll generally have both, and if they don't and they're capacitated, we'll send them to Doris or some other attorney in town to have the other one drawn up, because you need both. You can, in terms of the medical power of attorney, for any listener out there that's thinking, my gosh, I don't have one, go Google Virginia Advanced Medical Directive, and the state provides a form that is a combination of you appointing an agent to make medical decisions for you, but it's also your opportunity to sort of announce the types of acute care intervention you do and don't want.
What does that mean?
Meaning, do you want to be...
Meaning, pull the... And I'm going to be just slang about this. That means you can feed me or not feed me if I'm...
Exactly that. So it's decisions around, do you want to be intubated? And that's intubation. You know, we see it on the TV shows. It's awful. Generally speaking, you've got to be heavily sedated because most people tend to tug at it. You're often tethered by your wrists and ankles while you're intubated. And look, it's one thing if you're trying to get over a bout of pneumonia and we think, you know, you'll pull through. This is a temporary course of action. But if intubation is forever, people ought to think about that. Artificial nutrition, hydration, CPR. I mean, what you're trying to do is tell your loved ones how far to push it. You know, you're not seeking a cure for mortality, but you may want every reasonable chance that you've got. I will see in my line of business well-intentioned family members sacrifice a loved one's precious time outside of an ICU, their money, their freedom from pain in pursuit of a cure for mortality. Again, well-intentioned people who will do anything and everything to keep mom alive. That may not be what mom wants. It may not even be in mom's best interest in terms of helping her establish and maintain a good condition of existence. So you've got to know thyself and then complete this document in such a way that you are clear with the people who would be making a decision when you can't.
So let me make clear what she's talking about, because there's a lot of kind of medical jargon that's flying around now. When we talk about intubation, when you're 85, 90 years old and you're very frail and they jam that tube down your throat, it is not a gentle process. If you have dentures in, they may get broken. The back of your throat may get bruised up. If they do CPR on your chest and you're 90 years old and you have osteoporosis, the chances of your ribs being broken are pretty good. And 5 minutes later, you're going to code again, your heart stops, and if you haven't given instructions not to do it, they're going to do it again. It's a pretty intense situation when those things are happening. If you have not indicated what your wants and desires are, someone else is going to make those decisions for you. It may not be your loved ones. It may be the doctor on the scene. And their oath is, A, rescue, B, do no harm. But they have to balance that because they don't know at that time until they stabilize you. When we talk about feeding, artificial feeding, that's not one of those shakes. What do they call those diet things? That
Ensure?
Ensure. It's not an Ensure shake. It's not even necessarily an IV nutrients. It's a nasogastral tube put up your nose and into your stomach like we do with prisoners on Guantanamo. And that's how you're given nutrition or surgically implanted. If you're not able to swallow because you're intubated, that's what's going to happen.
Let me ask a question. So if you do have a statement saying, I'd rather not live this way, carry on this way, but there are family members who live overseas who would like to come give their last goodbye, will the hospital do this anyway for another couple days while this family member makes their path homeward?
So the question you're really asking me is, who makes that decision? And if I have not given my instructions to someone who is authorized to make that decision, probably the doctors are going to have to decide, or the ethics committee will be convened and make a decision. And if you're, and I don't mean to be critical of any one institution, but if you're a hospital and their patient has insurance that will cover ICU treatment, we can keep people alive for a very long time on, you know, mechanics alone, on feeding someone, hydrating someone, intubating someone. So if the family says, or the doctors decide, oh, well, we have family members that are coming from overseas, yes, we do want to keep this person, quote unquote, alive, they can. Should they? You decide. You better put that in your advance directive.
Got it. All right. Again, our guests today, Doris Gelman and Katie Caverly, as we talk about elderly law and care. 11:49 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Now, let's switch to something. Not that that wasn't in some ways exploitation, but let's talk about exploitation in a different manner. Because I think both of you can probably talk to this. We hear about this all the time, whether it's on TV, in the news, in the paper, exploitation of the elderly, just in something simple like a telephone scam. How do the two of you deal with this? Katie, let's talk with you.
Yeah, sure. It's funny you start with the telephone scam, because the vast majority of financial exploitation of elders is committed by someone they know. Statistic is something like 9 out of 10 cases of elder exploitation, the perpetrator is a close family member or caregiver. Now, the telephone scams happen. We do a couple of things. We'll put our clients on the do not call list. We have moderate to poor success with that. You can go to the Department of Justice website. They've got an elder section, and on that they keep a running tally of the nation's top scams of the week, of the month, so you can sort of stay apprised of what those telephone scammers are doing. But by far, people ought to be more worried about exploitation by someone they know. And, you know, that sort of abuse is underreported and underprosecuted, although I'm glad to say that it's starting to change in Albemarle and Charlottesville. But the damage is so much more than financial. If you think about it, having been betrayed by a loved one, we will really see physical health rapidly decline in the aftermath of an exploitation. In addition to the financial loss, there's just this sense of shame and embarrassment. And
which is part of the reason it's underreported.
Right.
Can you talk about, can you give me a, explain what you're talking about? I'm, you know, when I say exploitation, I say telephone scam, I think everybody knows what we're talking about.
Yeah. So let's say there is a son who is appointed his agent for his mother, and is paying her bills, paying the mortgage, paying what he ought to, but he's also sliding himself some checks. He's paying his own mortgage, or he's visiting the safe deposit box where there is gold bullion, and suddenly that starts going missing. We see, and there's no science to this, I'll just tell you sort of what I've witnessed. I kind of categorize exploitation into two root causes. Again, not scientific-based, but you've got the exploitation of circumstance, right? An otherwise honest, good soul sees a little opportunity to slide themselves some of mom's money, doesn't set out to be criminal, doesn't set out to exploit. But
it's what she would have wanted anyway.
And I'm going to inherit it anyway, right? And I've got this financial problem. I'm in the middle of a divorce, and I'm having trouble making this month's rent.
She would want me to
She wouldn't want me to suffer like this. So we see that type where you just sort of fall into it. You didn't really set out to be criminal, but lo and behold, you are. The other type of exploitation I see is what I call exploitation of vengeance, where there may very well have been terrible family dynamics. Maybe mom wasn't a great mom. And there's always been a power dynamic where mom is vastly superior over the child. Well, time shifts, and that equation changes, right? Suddenly, mom is vulnerable, and there is this adult, angry child that now has power. And they view that circumstance as an opportunity to seek revenge. Again, they may not consciously be aware that they're seeking revenge, but we will enter the scene where, look, we know that there are decades of family dynamics here we'll never fully understand and we'll never solve for. But I do meet some adult children who are so angry that when that power shift takes place, there's some very primal sense of corrupt righteousness that sets in where they want to go after that.
Sorry, don't want to cut you off, but there is a third category of people who are downright bad actors, right? And that often springs from a place where you have a son, a daughter, a nephew, or whatever, has a drug addiction problem, has a gambling problem, mental illness. All of those things contribute to this. Sometimes they're just thieves and dishonest, but they have gained access to what appears to be a legal source if under power of attorney. Mm-hmm. But as I said before, you can be sued for breach of fiduciary duty. You can also be charged with a crime,
right?
To use a power of attorney for something that is not in mom's best interest or the principal's best interest, it is a crime called embezzlement. And you can be charged with that crime, and you can be convicted of that crime, and you can go to jail for that crime.
Again, we're winding down on the hour as we talk about elderly law and care with Doris Gelman and Katie Caverly, and there's just so much to talk about. I hope the two of you will come on again in the not-too-distant future. There's no way we can even talk about how to find your assisted living facility and nursing facility, and it's depth that it needs, but I feel the need to ask the question. So, because this is important, so if you can talk for a minute or two about the difference, the key difference between assisted living facility and nursing facilities.
I want to get one important point in on that note, and then I'll turn it over to Katie. The most important difference between assisted living and nursing care is assisted living is not medical care. Nursing homes qualify for medical care, insurance, Medicaid will pay for it, will not pay in assisted living. It is private pay or long-term care insurance is the only way you're going to pay for that.
Yeah, you know, we sort of look at independent living, which is literally just, say, for example, an apartment complex that's got an age restriction on it. Then you've got assisted living, which, as Doris says, is paid for only privately or a long-term care insurance policy. But that's suggestive that you simply need some help with activities of daily living, bathing, dressing, transferring, eating. And those communities will assess you before you enter to determine what level of care you need. There are a lot of communities around town that sort of organize themselves wisely, I think, as these continuums of care, right, where there are pockets of care within that community to cover every breadth, every health status along that continuum.
My grandmother calls those 1-2-3s, where you start in the ones.
Yep.
And then they move you to the twos as you need them, and then the threes.
It's not really graduating. It's kind of a descending scale.
Well, 3-2-1.
3-2-1s. But they have everything from you go in and you're happy because you really want to get rid of some stuff and live there, and then the threes are more like the dementia.
The thought being that transfer trauma, right? The trauma of being uprooted from what is both physically familiar, but also, I think, culturally familiar about where you live, that's a real thing. And so these continuums are trying to mitigate that, right? You can start in independent, graduate to assisted, and move to skilled as necessary, or memory care.
But doing my homework through the two of you for this is that it never costs what they tell you it's going to cost.
Correct.
And don't get tricked by the brick and mortar part of the visit.
I came home and told my husband not too long ago, I said, my gosh, you need money to grow old. I wish that weren't the case, but the more I do this, the more I'm convinced of the truth of it.
And we, you know, I feel like I should have started this part of the show at 11:30, but then, of course, he would have never gotten to the rest of it.
We'll come back.
I hope so. Yeah. I'd like you to come back sometime early in the new year, because I feel that after the holidays, when people spend more time with the parents and the families, is when a lot of this will be fresh in people's minds. So I hope we can do that. Again, Doris Gelman at GelmanLaw.com. That's Gelman with a B in it. And Katie Caverly, Managing Director of I-Core Charlottesville. That's I-K-O-R, Charlottesville.com. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Next week, we'll be talking about bees with John Gooch and learn all about the bees. Thanks very much.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.